The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Email ray at rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551. Whenever we do parenting on this programme, we get a huge response. So there's a lot of people out there who need advice on parenting. Colman Nochter is a child and adolescent psychotherapist. He works in this area. So we invited him back in. And we're offering his services to you free of charge. Is that okay, Colman? That's right. Okay, like we got a huge response, some really interesting ones. Let's see how we go. Dear Ray and Colman, I live in a house with my ex-husband and two teenagers. The atmosphere is strained, to say the least. My question is, how do I even attempt to parent effectively when I feel my authority has been systematically undermined over the years? I'm confronted with statements such as, I don't have to do what you say, and if you try and stop me, I'll just tell Dad and you won't get your check. I'm a stay-at-home mum. My two children are well financed by their father, the elder being presented with their own car. Whenever I try to enforce rules or even just basic good manners, they can simply pack their bags and head off to my in-laws, giving me the two fingers. I really saw red when I discovered their father was supplying them with alcohol, as he said they were unable to purchase it themselves, being underage. These are just examples. I tried to explain that while undermining and degrading me as their mother might bring short-term satisfaction, that it was very damaging to the children in the long term. I've always desisted from discussing my marital problems with them or in front of them, as I deem it to be entirely inappropriate. However, this is not the case with my ex or my in-laws. Things are reaching crisis levels. They're missing school, etc. I'm trying hard to retain my sanity. Any advice on how to raise teenagers in this truly awful situation? It sounds horrific, Colman.
Yeah, horrific and unfortunately common. In any sort of where there's a kind of acrimonious separation or anything like that, there's a process for triangulation happens, where the child becomes the currency for throwing mudslinging at each other. And it's a really short-term way of thinking about it. I'll get one over on somebody by doing that. Unfortunately, in this listener's situation, she seems to, the financial power seems to be not in her favour. And so the idea that dad can wallow them in gifts and there's a kind of a freedom for them to walk out whenever they wish, buying them alcohol underage, dad's befriending and he's getting compliance through
bribes,
yes. Monetary favors,
currying favor, yeah.
And that's a short-term strategy in terms of from a child's point of view. The material stuff weighs down. It's really important for all of these children are going through something too. Like they're going to be angry. Like children in homes that are still together will split mum against dad. But in this situation, it's kind of fair game in their view that this is entrusted upon them. They're angry that this is the situation. What I would say is many people opt to stay in the same house after a separation.
Well, they probably have to.
And have to for financial reasons. It's really... it creates such unpleasant atmospheres, and where children will oftentimes, when they're with mum, might be worried about dad, or when they're with dad, they may be worrying about mum, and you know, where they're splitting between two homes, that brings its own difficulties. But in that one house where there's a kind of a toxic atmosphere, there's no sanctuary for these children. So there's probably a rage and a fury that they're taking out. Mum just seems to be the easy target in this situation. My guess in this situation is to try and get this partner to see some long-term sense.
Right.
The value of being able to compromise, being able to negotiate, the ability to even negotiate interpersonal relationships, all of these things these children are not learning. By the sounds of things, they're young teenagers. So they're learning that, you know, bullying my way gets what I want. You know, manipulation is key. And they're really learning all the wrong messages.
Do you think he'll see sense? If he is short-sighted enough and stupid enough to use his teenage children as pawns to get back at his ex, do you think you could actually talk sense to somebody like that?
I think there is ways in which we can talk to most people around. I mean, if you can get back to these are your children, and if you have any concern for your children's long-term welfare, you need to invest in teaching them the right message. And at the moment, although it may be a short-term gratification for you to getting one over, your children are not learning any messages from this. And that will backfire on him. You know, this isn't how you yeah. sustain you long nurturing yourself. Relationships. Yeah. What I would suggest is that the chances are these children, if they're learning those tactics, will get into other problems outside of their home environment, yeah. albeit they will try that strategy with teachers in school or whatever it might be, and that may be where the problem arises, and it comes to the point where it has to be addressed. This lady seems like she's the reasonable one, but in their minds, she's probably the naggy, unpopular rule enforcer. In an ideal world, it'd be sharing the good cop, bad cop role, where dad has to come with some bad news sometimes. And dad should have to pick up the pieces of some of the bad decisions that he makes, that mum shouldn't be kind of rushing in there to do that. I feel for mum in this situation because she just wants what's best for her children. She wants to teach them something, and she's trying to emulate that by trying to be passive and not mudslinging in that direction. And I wouldn't suggest that's the way to go, but it is working on dad.
She needs to have a chat with him. She's had numerous chats with him.
I mean, I would, in this situation, I'd like to both of them to go and see a third person who would sit them down and say, and it's not about getting someone to give out to dad for all the stuff he's going wrong, because you know, we don't know what's going on for dad in this situation either. But a mediator in this situation is to try and find some common ground. And unfortunately, this is one of those situations where there isn't a quick fix. There isn't a, you know, this lady's obviously thought about this an awful lot. I don't think she's missed anything in this. This is one of those ongoing, evolving problems.
And you're saying it's quite common where people separate, living under the same roof with children, toxic environment.
There's such bitterness and anger and frustration over, you know, you took my life from me, or, you know, you made a decision to not be with me anymore. And, you know, vengeance is something that I'm invested in trying to equal. But the common issue is parents trying to befriend their children through leniency and no boundaries and kind of...
and that doesn't work.
Unthought out support.
Doesn't work.
It does not work. Because the child's not learning to respect you, they're learning to manipulate you.
Right. Well, I hope that works out in the future. Hi there. This is for the child psychologist. My six-year-old puts himself down when I reprimand him. He'll say things like, "I knew I was useless. Oh, I'm so stupid." He's quite sensitive and won't go on play dates with other children without me. But this is is popular and has lots of friends. How can I increase his self-confidence?
Yeah. First thing I would say is that this is very common, and amongst that age group, that kind of self-defeating kind of "I'm an awful person because I'm in trouble." Sometimes that can be authentically well felt. Sometimes that's manipulative to almost to respond back with, "Oh no, you're not." You know. But from the point of view of this, what I would say about mum, she'd mentioned self-confidence here, and I think this is for most parents who are listening. This is really important. Self-confidence is very different to self-esteem. The amount of parents I see come into me and say, "I want my child to be more confident." Your confidence is how you project yourself into the outside world. So you can be confident at football, sports, all those things. Self-esteem is your own evaluation of your own value.
So it's more important.
So it's much more important. The most important relationship you will ever have in your life is with yourself. Yeah. So that notion of, you know, I might portray myself confidently in this space with you now, but I might go off air and go, "Oh my God, I was rubbish and I wasted a half an hour of that person's life," or you know, whatever it might be. So my truth is the only truth. So what you want this child is to really work on their self-esteem, not their self-confidence. He has friends. He can portray a confidence. He can socially engage. That's fine. This is in his own evaluation of himself. So I would be bigging up his little quick wins. So the things, but it's not about you saying you're a great hurler, you're a great footballer, you're a great this. It's about getting him to see it. So when he does something, say he's kind to his sibling or something, and say, "You know, what did you think you did there?" "Well, I helped my sister out when she was struggling." That's a really nice quality. And so you're getting him to articulate what his value is, and trying to see value much more as a holistic thing, rather than we've gotten into a very dangerous area where we reward
goal achievement.
We reward outcome, not effort.
Yes.
And really, like in my view, the child who has dyslexia, who puts 2 hours in to getting 6 out of 10, deserves as much praise as the kid who gets
more.
10 out of 10
yes.
who puts 10 minutes in. And we need to become more valued on that. So this child needs to value his own effort.
And is there a phase that children go through where they do that? They sort of, I know I was useless, oh, I'm terrible.
Yeah, I mean, childhood is a kind of a really safe but unusual place because everything's so black and white. So you're good or you're bad. You're never anything in between.
Right.
And, you know, so the idea that, you know, I'm the tallest, so I'm the best, or, you know, yes, my daddy beat your daddy up. It's a wonderfully simple world. But it has, in the dial will always flip to I'm awful or I'm brilliant.
Right.
So you'll have a 7-year-old who, like my daughter will dance in watching Ireland's Got Talent and turn around and say, will I go on that next year? And she genuinely believes that she's of that ability. But the other, well, if you give up to my eldest son, give out to him for something small, he will go into this zone of, oh my God, I'm a terrible person because I've let you down. And, you know, so that type of child, though, there's a blessing and a curse. You know, they are wonderfully thoughtful friends. They are absolutely, you know, I would say I was probably a bit like that myself and probably helps me in this career to empathize with other people and have that beauty. But the ruminative, over-analytic child is something that carries an awful burden, you know, in terms of they're probably thinking far too much.
Yeah. You know, get out of your head. Yeah.
This is the 5-year-old who says, you know, Dad, does a duck know he's a duck? You know, that sort of little philosopher. Which
does he?
I still haven't worked that out. But from the point of view of that depth of thinking is something that's wonderfully skillful and supportive.
It's a gift, but it can
be a lot to carry. Yeah. For this lad, it's just get him to see his own value, really his self-worth, try and work on self-esteem, not self-confidence.
And that's hugely important for all parents, isn't it? Esteem versus confidence. I have a question for Coleman. I have a 10-year-old son who sometimes refuses to go to school. He says there is no real reason. Seems like general anxiety. He is very anxious on those mornings. He changed school 2 years ago when we moved. Any tips on how to handle it on the days when he refuses to go? Any cajoling from me doesn't work. You have to go to school approach doesn't work either. A reward approach doesn't work. Those mornings are very stressful for us all. So any advice would be much appreciated. Many thanks.
You kind of ran through most of the approaches there. I mean, the firm kind of you have to go to school under any circumstances, it has its drawbacks if the child is genuinely struggling. So like any situation, you're looking at this from the point of view of, is this child unwilling or unable? And the distinction is very hard to make, but it's a really important one, because if you push an unable child into something, they're going to feel overwhelmed. Whereas you allow an unwilling child to stay away, you're going to reinforce that behaviour.
Yeah.
What I'd say in any school situation, look at it from two points of view. Is this a fear of being in school? So is it teachers? Is it the work? Is it the
bullying,
peers?
It could be anything.
The other thing is it a desire to be at home? So this is one thing we don't tend to think about. So attachment in terms of worried about mum, you know, is mum going to be okay if I'm, you know, in school? And children do worry about that. And they worry about kind of almost their refusal is based on not so much a fear of going to where they're going, but leaving where they're leaving. So the point of view is to look at her own relationship, you know, and sometimes we can make comments like, oh my God, how am I going to get through the day without you? And I miss you. And
casual, but they mean a lot to a child.
These children are sponges. And so they're soaking all that stuff in. He did move 2 years ago. I would explore to a great extent how he is settling in. You know, people allow this settling in period to stretch over years, you know, but he still might be the new kid. If there hasn't been anyone come in since, he might not want that and may not like that. So I'd explore everything that I can with him. The approach I would say is best in this situation is firm support. So what you're saying is you have to go to school, and that's really important. You have to try. And, you know, if there's a problem in there, then we'll do anything we can to approach it. And I wouldn't make empty promises about everything's going to be fine in school, because if he's having a tough time that he's not telling you about, that's falling on deaf ears. I would say in this situation, you adopt the same approach as you would in a roller coaster, which is you sit beside your child and say, I don't know what's up ahead here. I don't know whether this could be scary or not, but we're in it together. So whatever it is, we got this. And almost just try and take that approach to it rather than the false promises, the incentive-based stuff.
But and talk to people in school as well to see if there is any problem.
I mean, I think parents are kind of have this worry that they'll burden teachers with this. You know, you have this notion of, and there are parents out there who have that firm path worn to the teacher about every little thing. But if you're not that type of parent, I don't think a teacher's going to have a great deal of issue with you. And I would always encourage parents to find out what, you know, waiting for the November and February parent-teacher meeting is sometimes too long, especially, you know, this lad, he might be sitting on his own at break time. He might just not be enjoying the games. He might not be as sport. naughty as the other children, and he might have different interests. And it's just about kind of buddying him in there, giving him a help in scaffolding him around that. That could make a huge difference. But a 3 month period of doing that,
it's a long time.
I was in that situation, I'd want a break from it too.
Okay. Now, Coleman Ray, my 7-year-old daughter has recently become very anxious about becoming ill and having to go to hospital. She recently had a scare where she thought she was choking and she completely panicked. She started hyperventilating and shaking. This panic attack, now that's in inverted commas, so I don't know if they know if it was a panic attack, has happened a number of times since when she has a small pain in her tummy, etc. In the past, she had to have bloods taken at the doctors, which took numerous attempts, and she also had an investigation in hospital, which also took numerous attempts to get blood. She was quite traumatised after this, but as it was a few years ago, I thought she was over it. What can I do to help with her anxiety?
Yeah, the physical fear anxiety is not an uncommon one either. Oftentimes children who perhaps have a vomiting episode may fear swallowing and they want their food blended, and they'll have these kind of excessive reactions or disproportionate reactions to it, and it becomes almost phobic from that point of view. This little girl seems like she's had an experience of physical investigations which she's almost taken some sort of traumatization from and is kind of fearful of that reoccurring. Again, what you're trying to do in this situation, it doesn't sound, I'd be loosely using the term panic attack, because a panic attack is fairly specific clinical condition
that's why I think maybe it's in inverted commas, because
but certainly those episodes of panic response, you know, in that moment you're trying to just absolutely de-escalate the physical sides of anxiety, which is the heart beating, the pumping sweat, and that and you're trying to talk that down. So you're going with the classic, you know, this will pass, you're okay. There's some wonderful things you can do. I mean, she's 7, she might be a little bit old for this, but you know, these strategies around teddy bears, going to doctors and getting things checked out, and you're trying to, what she really needs is a corrective emotional experience. So she needs to go to somewhere where she's
and have a nice experience,
and have a nice experience of that, and then as she exposes herself to that, then that becomes less and less traumatic. So she only has this one baseline experience, which was fairly traumatic, and every tummy pain and every cough or every issue where she has a nausea is she's going back to the trauma event.
And is there a phase, because I saw with our daughter there, where mortality and all that becomes, they have a really sharp focus on that, about people getting sick, people dying. If I don't drink enough water, am I going to faint? All that sort of thing. And it passed.
Yeah, it does. And that's all to do with object permanency.
Well, so, object permanency. Vernacular.
Take the small child. So when we go, the peekaboo, gone, back.
Oh, they, yes.
Gone,
yes,
back.
Yes.
So Freud called that the fourth da. So it comes and it goes. So once you know that something's coming back, that kind of allows you to kind of know that you're going to be kept in mind. So when mum leaves or dad leaves and they come back, the repetition of that says everything's going to be okay, everything's going to be fine. People go, but they come back. Really important learning skill for a child to learn that object permanency. Then the concept of death is introduced. So this is permanent absence. And this for children is, what? You know, there's this whole, you know, and I've went through this with my own children. Do you die when you're 100?
Yes.
You know, when will you die?
Yes.
You know? And so they're checking out object permanency, because the whole notion of containment is that the environment is able to remain the same. And that feeling of containment and safety is that even if things go awry or things go wrong or there's adversity, things are going to be okay. But in the classic situation, the loss of the parental figure is the biggest worry that children have. And if you can indulge you for a little bit, there's a guy called Bruno Bettelheim, and he did this thing on fairy tales. Now, if you think about the fairy tales, like the Hansel and Gretel, Snow White's, can you think of what they all got in common? There's no parents.
Right?
So what the fairy tale is this notion that even the weak can survive without the loss of the parent figure. So these are the classics that have withstood time. So a child listening to this about how Hansel and Gretel and all these children survive, and Harry Potter clues into this too, that you can survive the loss of your most feared object, they get reassurance and containment from that.
Right.
So they want to check it out all the time. So that checking out around 7, 8, around when are you going to die, and especially if there is a death, a grandmother or something like that, or an aunt or someone in the community, that can really derail children's sense of permanency, that in actual fact, I could actually lose somebody who's really important to me, and this could be devastating.
Yes.
Who'll look after me if you go? All that sort of stuff. So it becomes a preoccupation, but it's a phase that as the child kind of cottons on that everyone's not going to die tomorrow, they can usually move on from right. this child.
Is this part of that then?
This child is her own object permanency. Yes. So will I die? Will yes. I? Will something happen to me that I will no longer be available to you, or I will lose that connection with you, and which is the kind of source of my containment of my anxiety.
And I suppose it must be a pain in the bum to hear somebody like me say, it's just a phase, you'll be fine, because it's very real at the moment for yeah. this parent and this 7-year-old. Yeah.
And but I would put the house that this child will get better.
Yeah, better
this will
yes,
become
yes.
you know, as she becomes more robust and resilient. She's 7. She's just around the age of reason. You know, so you're just getting to that kind of sense. Now, anxiety can follow you through whole of your life and take different forms around, you know, worrying about exams or worrying about jobs and all this.
You're a worrier. I'm a worrier.
Yeah, yeah, and that's just, yeah. that's hardwired.
Is there a gene? Yeah, it's a gene, isn't
yeah,
it?
It is
a worry gene.
It's
yeah.
a way of being rather yes. than a way of thinking if yes. you're just that way. And, you know, we can tell children of 18 months that they're going to be that way. And I think one of the things that you won't hear a lot of psychologists or psychotherapists come on here and talk about is temperament. And the reason is we don't know what it is.
All right.
We don't know how to affect it. We just have to work with it. But it's one of the most determining factors around our personality is your temperament. So you can't teach a fiery temperament kid to be calm. You just have to work with their fieriness.
Right, interesting.
And you can't teach a quiet, meek kid to be lively
and is that nature or nurture? I'll have to leave you with this.
I don't know. I challenge anyone else to come up with the answer. But it's that one stable, consistent issue that we have to work with.
But I'd say a lot of parents out there recognise their own temperament in their children.
Absolutely.
Now, whether that is learnt or whether it's genetic, that's the...
And I'll take the easy way out and say, it's probably a bit of both, right? But from the point of view... But I can see it in my own. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's certainly that transfer of that. But what I'd say to you is, sometimes we think, oh, there's one parenting strategy that'll solve every child. Parenting the skill of parenting is being able to change your approach with a different child. So the one temperament needs one might need the softly, the other might need the firm approach. And so it's about being able to decipher which is which. That's probably what the skill is.
Yeah, and hold this girl's hand, and she needs a positive experience in a sort of medical situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're just trying to reprogram her associations. But I would say this kid needs support. She needs the carrot as opposed to the stick in this sense, because that anxiety is really genuine, but just not about what she's talking about.
And it happens to an awful lot of 7-year-olds.
It's common. It's not, I'm not no, diminishing that experience.
It
it's really
common.
Difficult, but you're not on your own.
Yeah. Coleman, you'll come in again.
Of course I will, yeah.
We only got through a fraction of the problems that people have with their parenting. So Coleman Nochter will be with us again. We might even get you your own email address, Coleman, for the show. Thanks for the moment.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.